Good evening. We've got a two-parter for you this evening between now and 10 o'clock, and I hope you stay tuned. We have a free-for-all upcoming as soon as we've had the opportunity to put together two gentlemen for the first time on any talk radio program together. We have Bill Graham, who is the best known of all the rock impresarios in the United States, and next to him is the biographer of the rock and roll movement. His name is Steve Chappell. He's the author of the book called Rock and Roll is Here to Pay. When Steve was here on the program with me, I guess it was about a month or so ago, there were some comments made and some ideas advanced, and Bill Graham phoned in, and the two of them discussed it, and I suggested that they get together here in the studio to talk it out between the two of them. And so that's what they're doing. They're here in the studio tonight, and then we're going to open the lines for callers with questions for either or both of the gentlemen. Upcoming in a flash.
Now, smooth Kava romance. The dull love story where everything runs smoothly. Thanks to Kava. Smooth coffee that's real coffee. Here's to 7 smooth years together, Samantha.
Smooth but dull.
And here's to Kava, the coffee that puts smooth into our life.
If only we had a bitter fight now and then.
But Kava took bitterness out of our life.
An occasional squabble.
Samantha, I see a future of smooth sipping with you, me, and Kava.
Maybe I'll have an affair.
Have a love affair with the smooth, rich taste of Kava. Kava is never bitter because it's 90% acid neutralized. This unique process softens bitter coffee acid for a really smooth taste. Yet Kava is real coffee, no cereal or grain, for a real coffee taste.
Have a cup of Kava. What a cup of smooth, real coffee.
Fight with me, Samuel.
I can't. I'm sipping smooth Kava. Try Kava Instant Coffee. Smooth coffee that's real, real coffee that's smooth. From Borden.
Okay, let's get the mics on right now. And let me inquire. Are the 3 mics on properly? Okay, that's good. Now, I'm looking at a copy of the book, Rock and Roll is here to Pay. I have marked 3 portions of the book that I figure that maybe you, Bill Graham, might take exception to. Page 140, I have marked. Another one on page, a reference on page 147, and a reference on page 153. What do you object to in the book? Are they those passages or are they others, Bill?
Well, there are certain statements about the industry that we can talk about. The things I tend to always object to the most are things that encroach on my person, whatever integrity I might have. There's one in particular, and I think you picked up the page 140, where there's a reference to the hip capitalist, Bill Graham, and which then goes on to relate to whatever he may or may not have done that he may not have had to do. This is the work of, let's say, benefit concerts or advice where there's no money involved or no financial, no monetary gain. And
why don't I read this for the benefit of the listeners?
It's on the bottom.
All right, I know where it is.
Okay,
Steve, is it okay if I read your writing?
Sure.
Okay, that's fine. We're close to the mic, please. Okay, soon after the Northwestern tour, the Dead, meaning the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and a number of other San Francisco and Berkeley groups announced that they were no longer willing to be promoted by Bill Graham, who was accused of ripping off the Bay Area youth community and its culture and putting nothing back. Then there's an asterisk. I'm not a freakout, said Graham. I'm not a hippie. I don't sell love. I sell talent and environment. Then the asterisk refers to the footnote, which says, since his early days as a hip capitalist, Graham has tried to incorporate and blunt the left's criticism, that's left in caps, that he ripped off the community. He's done a lot of benefit concerts more than any other promoter. On some of them, he got paid for his services, but took no profit. On other occasions, he has operated wholly at his own expense. What is surprising in all of this is not that Graham has thrown some of his time in for charity, but that other concert promoters have not been forced to do likewise. It may be, as Don Law suggests, that, quote, Graham creates his own problems by being so dramatic all the time, or as Barcelona observes, in quotes, by trying to identify with his audience and wear blue jeans and all that, end quote. Now, Steve says, Barcelona moves around in a chauffeured limousine, has never been attacked as a rip-off pig. For whatever reasons, Graham is an exception that proves the rule, and not much of an exception at that. His middling contributions to charity amount to a few hours of his time. The money is all from the audience that goes to the benefits. Seen as a percentage of his overall profits and time, the charity work is a minuscule part of his total operation. Graham's benefit concerts are comparable to the pro bono, for the good of the public, legal services offered for free in a limited way by Wall Street law firms. Well, let me see if I can deduce something from that, Steve, before we give it to Bill to answer. The impression I get is that Graham is the only guy who is doing anything at all for the community, anything at all for charity, that the other rock promoters are not doing anything.
Right. We try to, and throughout the book, give everybody their due, and it seems to me that Bill Graham has done more concerts than almost any other promoter. We talk about the kind of constant tension between what we call hip capitalists, that is somebody who has a love of the music, like Mr. Graham seems to have, and gets along with performers in that, versus somebody who's clearly identified as a businessman and identifies themselves as that, someone like Mr. Barcelona or Don Law or other New York promoters, people who are really not even into rock music, who told us, frankly, that they listened to, they were more into Tin Pan Alley Decadence or into classical music when they got home. So we wanted to put both sides down, but nevertheless, it, in terms of the bulk of the money that is being made, although there's an attempt to, like, keep one foot in the street and one at the top of you know, Marin Hilltops, nevertheless, it really isn't a whole lot different in the end than Clark Clifford doing legal services in the South Bronx or something.
Well, I'm rather awed. The Marin Hilltops. I'm wondering what I'd like to answer that. What your definition is of how a man who succeeds in our business, how should he act? Should he live in the Coldwater flat? First of all, I've never worn Levi's in my life. I think I wore them one day somewhere. Somebody lent me a pair. I don't wear Levi's. I've never considered myself a hippie or a hip capitalist. But you say Graham never puts money in. The most valuable thing I have is time and experience, and to use that experience within time. And on the back of the book, it mentions that for a period of time, I think in the East and the Northwest and the Northeast, you spent some time with a not-for-profit called Entropy, and you put on some benefit concerts. Now, if that took some of your time, what did we not do that you had to do practically full-time? If you wanted to do a benefit concert, now the fact that we have a large company doesn't mean that a tremendous amount of time isn't taken. I think you also miss a very important factor, that every time a benefit is done in a community, we don't have 20 million people. In the Greater Bay Area, you got 2 to 3 million people. When you take $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000, or $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, but you take substantial amounts of money out of a community, that means that's really rock and roll money, and it's difficult to compete with that. So if you put on a show that takes $100,000 out of the community, I'd have to be very careful as a businessman to compete with that show, because that money is leaving this community. And if it's an R&B show, I couldn't promote an R&B show that weekend. Or if it's a snack show where we had Dylan and the Dead and Starship and all these, and we had $400,000 or $500,000 leave the Bay Area, we couldn't do a show for 2 or 3 weeks on either side. And when you say, well, what does Graham lose? First of all, we gain a great deal, but there's time and there's experience and there's logistics and there's personnel.
Well, as I said, we're not arguing with that, and we're not arguing that you don't do concerts the best, and that those benefit concerts aren't elegantly run, tasteful, great, start on time. We're just trying to point out, and this is sort of an ironic footnote, that Bill Graham is different than a lot of other promoters, that it's a kind of strange industry. We talked earlier about managers. Someone like Elliot Roberts, who does Joni Mitchell, is a different sort of manager in the 1960s than some person in the 50s who's just into a sleazy rip-off thing. And we say the same thing is true of record companies, that those record companies who simply had the idea that the music was there to be ripped off, that the idea was to get hold of the publishing, to kill an act as quickly as possible, lost out, and that those folks who were hipper, who were closer, who had a love for the music, and I think you'd fit in that category, were smarter in the long run.
Now, you see, let me ask you, if I may, when this book was written, did you ever decide that perhaps you should call me and talk to me?
Yeah, I thought you'd ask me that question. I had I came up to San Francisco and did a long interview with Tom Donahue, and this is we wrote you a letter, you know, to do that, but you said that
that your schedule was too busy in the next few months and that you would not be doing any interviews, and although it was very flattering of you to ask, good luck with the project. We made every effort to talk to just about everybody. I don't think everyone realizes that their name is now in print and, mm-hmm. and indexed, and it's kind of funny. I was down on a station, K101, in L.A., and it turned out that the interviewer kept going back to radio and payola and formats and Top 40. And, of course, it turned out that Bill Drake owned the station and had fed in a few questions and had wondered why we hadn't called up him to get the legend straight. And, of course, we had. I mean, some people, Phil Spector's and Bill Graham's are hard to get a hold of, and some people sat still for our tape recorders.
Here is the crux of what I object to. You say his middling contributions to charity amount to a few hours of his time. Now, you want to come in the office sometime, anytime, not just when we do benefits, it's when we talk people out of doing shows that they shouldn't do. If you want to clock the amount of time that's put in just a public service in the office, you'll be somewhat astounded. More important, that the record companies or the publishing companies or managers or agents, or including myself, I won't sit here and tell you the monetary contribution that we make to various causes, because then you become hounded by other causes who want your money. Now, record companies, I know, donate millions, not thousands, millions. Our company, off the air, I will be glad to take you into our offices and show you what is done for various, if it's a drug clinic, it's a children's center, whatever, but this is not to give ourselves a medal to be awarded a philanthropic award. But these are not things that you make public. But I don't even think they have to be. What you really miss out on is the amount of time spent on benefits, which is money, because that time could be spent on shows that we could do, and we're also depriving ourselves of income by putting on benefit shows at a time when we don't have to do them.
Let me ask you about one concert. This may have been your first benefit concert. It probably was. It was in the middle or the middle late 60s. It was a concert for the HALO. Remember the Haight-Ashbury Legal Organization? Right. It was a concert at
Winterland,
and
Dead.
Grateful Dead and the Quicksilver Messenger, Jefferson Airplane,
yes.
and a couple of other acts were there. Now, at that time, all of the contributions, they were said the contributions went to the Haight-Ashbury Legal Organization. Okay, what percentage of that came off the top, and what percentage went to the Haight-Ashbury Legal Organization?
All at benefits, the only monies that ever came out was what it cost for the rent or for the security or for the advertising. There were no profits made. And those are the areas that not in Steve's book, but I remember a classic line, which I'll never forget, in the review of that particular show, where Rolling Stone, and at that time Mr. Warner, was very brilliant in using me as the anti-hero.
No, in the 60s. There wasn't any Rolling Stone then.
Sure there was.
No, there wasn't.
Yes, there was. 1967 or 60. Yes, there was.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm positive.
Just after Gleason started it, then.
I'm positive.
Well,
yeah.
All right, I'll take your word for it.
Anyway, at the end of the wonderful concert, beautifully run, great, excellent amount of money was raised. Last sentence was something like, and we wonder what he made from that one. Now, is it not possible that we don't do that? Now, you're not making that accusation. There is no profit made. Now, when you say, sometimes we'll ask for if we have to rent a sound system, you must pay for the sound system. If we go to a prison and they want us to provide things, we will. But if a man works for me and I say I want to donate my equipment and my time, and the groups will donate their time and my stage to go to a prison or a hospital anywhere, I have no right to tell my sound guy, listen, I know you've got a wife and three kids, but this Sunday you're doing that benefit because I'm doing it for free. I can't do that. I'll tell him what the cause is. If you want to throw in your salary for the day, fine. Now, if he wants to be paid, there are times when I will pick it up, and there are times when I won't. But those are expenses of the gig. So you have the gross, and you take out the expense, and whatever is left goes to that benefit party. And more often than not, we don't even touch the money.
Catch your breath, gentlemen. I want to take a brief pause for the advertisers. I want to come back and ask you about point number two in the book, Rock and Roll is Here to Pay.
Every day, thousands of people have to get all kinds of documents delivered to all kinds of cities overnight. But nobody knows who to call.
Hello, Skyborne Air Freight? Listen, I've got this contract that has to be in Kenosha by tomorrow.
Kenosha? Tomorrow? Too bad they don't know about Federal Express Courier Pack. It's an envelope that holds up to 2 pounds of documents, contracts, blueprints, And anything you put in it can be practically any place in the country overnight.
Hello, post office? Listen, I've got this contract that has to be picked up and delivered to Kenosha by...
Picked up? And delivered?
We pick up, fly, and deliver your courier pack ourselves. And the cost? Just $14, door to door.
Hello, honey. I'll be late for dinner tonight. I've got this contract that has to be in Kenosha by tomorrow.
Kenosha? Tomorrow? Listen, why don't you call Federal Express? They can do it. I've seen their ads on TV. And if you get your nose out of that office...
Federal Express Courier Pack. When it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight.
And now, to address the graduation class of Barnyard Business School, may I present America's super salesman, a man with a mission, Quentin Quibble.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to enter a business world that's crying for quicker communications. But too many companies are still not acquainted with Quip and electronic mail. Quip is an incredible machine that can send a copy of almost anything you put on paper, a letter, a blueprint, a layout, across the country in 4 minutes flat, right over an ordinary office telephone. So be quizzical, America. If you get a job in an office not equipped with Quip, don't have any qualms about questioning why not. Remember, Quip is quicker than Messenger, quicker than Air Courier, and a zillion times quicker than Zip. So spread the word. Tell them that Quentin Quibble told you it's crazy not to use Quip. Thank you.
Quip, Q-W-I-P, from Quip Systems, a division of Exxon Enterprises, Inc. To inquire about equipping your office with Quip, call free, 800-221-2222.
It's crazy not to use Quip.
There's a little town on Seven Hills that's famous for its great Italian food. It's a town where people come from all over the world. A town where old men play bocce in the sun. Where waiters sing in the sidewalk cafes. And the good red wine flows and flows. And here in this beautiful little town, we make the best Italian food in the world. All from old family recipes. There's Riviera Minestrone. It's thick and rich with bacon bits and 14 garden fresh vegetables. There's Riviera Ravioli in beef, chicken, vegetable, or cheese. And now there's new Riviera Italiano tomato soup, too. Tonight, you and your family can enjoy all these special treats. Because now you can find Riviera Italian foods at your supermarket, where they're imported every day, fresh from that little town on Seven Hills. Riviera Italian foods, imported from San Francisco.
Riviera, imported from San Francisco, available at your local store. Now we go to page 147 of the book Rock and Roll is Here to Pay. Steve Chappell, one of the authors, is right here. Bill Graham, whom he's writing about, is on the other microphone. Late in 1970, Bill Graham announced he was shutting down the Fillmore's East and West. Within months, the Playground, Electric Factory, and Tea Party had also closed their doors. Graham made a typically stormy exit from the San Francisco rock scene. Typically enough, he made no real exit at all and returned the next year to establish his hegemony over the city's rock entertainment with concerts in the old Winterland Ice Palace and the Berkeley Community Theater. Towards the end of the ballroom days, however, when profits were wearing thin, the grumpy millionaire was given a hard time by Bay Area community organizations who wanted him to put money back into the San Francisco community. In New York, a local street gang who disguised their violence with political arguments attacked him physically. Is that a point of disagreement?
That's the next 4 hours.
Well,
you guys got to work into the mics.
Let's talk about, hegemony in the Bay Area. I mean, maybe we should depart a little bit. If that's something, I know when you called up, you were mad as a hornet that we talked about Monopoly, that we refer to a concert agency system. Or
yeah, Monopoly's on page 151.
Or Monopoly promoters, I mean, from time to time. That seemed to be the bone of contention. I don't know. That this other stuff is a little bit... history. We're not the same in this book as the people that have argued with you in the past, I think.
Well, we can deviate any way you like, but when you come up with remarks that are just totally false, the rest of the page just should be thrown out of your book. When you say, towards the end of the ballroom days, however, when profits were wearing thin, now I'll be glad to open my books to you. In the history of the organization, when you look at the number of people involved, this company of ours, in 1971, when we were closing, 70-71, in the history of this company and in the business, no more money was ever made in that era. And when the Fillmores were closed, they were at their all-time high. The reason the Fillmores were closed, because there was a certain statement made by a combination of facts, fate, will, in the 60s, that it came to a point where, voluntarily, I just said, I don't want to put up with a certain situation anymore, where I'm constantly battling groups not to go into Madison Square Garden, not to go into the Cow Palace, not to go into the bigger places. There was always an attempt to keep these shows closer to the public. When the prices went up, which were not set by the promoters, and are still not set by the promoters, that are set by the demands of the artists, rightfully because they're very popular, that is why these steps were taken. And when you say towards the end, when profits were wearing thin, you also mentioned...
Well, what we're talking about there in terms of the end is throughout the country, and you as more and more groups were asking higher and higher prices, as they could command that, as the British groups were broken and made it in America, and they were selling out into much bigger concert areas than the ballroom circuit, that created a bit of a problem for some promoters in that.
But we're not saying that
you didn't make a bushel basket of bread.
But you're speaking about media. You're saying late
night
Graham announced that he was shutting down his film wars, and then right after that, towards the end of the ballroom days, which is the same era, when profits were wearing thin, you also mentioned that...
Isn't it true that you did ads in Billboard and went into and did press conferences in which you said the acts were killing the ballrooms, that no one would be able to survive
the demand
if they continued to charge those kind of prices and escalate their prices?
Correct. But what has that got to do with profits? We continue to do shows in the ballrooms until such times that we couldn't do them in the ballroom. If the most you can take in a ballroom, let's say, is $25,000 in one night, and the band wants $20,000, you just can't do it.
Right, that's what we're saying.
So you're going to a bigger place. But so long as they were going to the smaller places, everybody was doing very well. And I chose not to do that because there was a change in the overall feeling of what was going about. I mean, we're all aware of that. We're all in our 30s and 40s now. But it wasn't just that. It was a combination of things. But what you're implying here, hey, Graham pulled out when it started to go bad. They were all-time high years. The Fillmore East.
No, what we're saying is
and West. Well, it was just shattering.
As the system changes, as say the Who could not get away with, I don't know, a couple thousand dollars in the Boston Tea Party or something, they could ask 10 times that or 5 times that as the years went on, then it forced people into garden area type of concerts, into places like the Cow Palace or the Spectrum in Philadelphia and that. And
which
the fact that
the
change,
ones that really broke into the big money? Which are the ones who first broke through? Were they the Brits?
No, it was the Cream or the Who or the
That's
Stones.
The Brits. And the Stones, the Brits.
Yeah, most.
They're
most
the ones who came in asking for the most bread.
Well, let's not point at them. Whoever it was the agent or the manager, or more than anything else. You see, it's not even the groups themselves. We live in a competitive society, which is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And a man has a 3,000-seater, and he says, "I'll pay $10,000 for an act." It's not much different today as it was then. And somebody else says, "I'll give you $50,000. The only difference is the building that I want to put you into is 5 times bigger." So the artist says, why not? So you spend a great deal of your time saying, what about the environment, or what about being close, or what about the distance between the microphone and the last person in the audience? And so you spend a great deal of time doing that, and you succeed, but what it takes out of you, and what you then put up with, is something that I didn't want to do anymore, and you have to start to realize we were running 2 places 3,000 miles apart, 52 weeks a year. So we got to a point where I decided, I just don't want to do this, because what I'm getting out of it, not financially, the spirit that I'm getting out of it for me, and if it sounds selfish, then it's selfish. I just don't want to do that. In the last year of the operation, in exchange for getting the Who to play 6 nights and getting the band to play and getting Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young to play a series of dates in these places, there were 39 round trips from June 70 to June 71. There were 39 round trips between San Francisco, New York, and San Francisco, for the purpose of maintaining the standards of the Fillmore. Why they were closed.
I saw in one show, one night, Richie Havens as the opening act for
Springfield.
The
mm-hmm.
Doors
mm-hmm.
with Jim Morrison. And it was a tremendous packed house at the Fillmore mm-hmm. here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, I have no idea what these guys were getting. Compare, this was must have been, what, 65, 66, 67, something like that.
Those probably had $5,000.
Okay, $5,000 for both of them. Richie Havens
no,
and
no,
the
Richie,
Doors.
Richie may have gotten $2,000.
All right. What today, if you get an act, 2 acts comparable to Richie Havens 10 years ago and the Doors 10 years ago, what would it cost to get those 2 acts to play a complete set like
you
they
mean,
did?
The ratio of popularity.
Yeah.
What they were then to the
That's
size
right.
of the business.
That's it, yeah.
Well,
what do you figure it would cost
well,
now
not,
for them?
It's not fair. It's not really fair to mention a group, but if a major attraction today in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Could easily demand a guarantee of $100,000 against the percentage of the door.
See, we're saying that it's not
There's nothing wrong with that. So does, I mean, what is Ali any different? Is Sphinx any different? How about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who makes... Does anybody say, why does that man earn $700,000
a year? Well, a lot of people do. It's sort of like, can GM charge the same amount of money? We don't come off and say, it's because Bill Graham and Don Law charge too much money. That's not why somebody is paying too much or paying twice as much as they did 5 years ago. That's not what causes inflated ticket prices. We say that's one thing. On the one hand, we say it's the huge amount that the groups are getting. It's the amount that that Bill Graham is getting. It's the amount that the agents are getting. And it's the fact that they can command it in this society. I don't think that it's fair that, you know, that Elton John can take home several million dollars a year any more than I think it's fair that Bill Graham can take home that kind of money.
How about Pete Rose?
I don't think it's that fair either.
Okay.
It's like, what are your assumptions and what are our assumptions in writing the book, right? I mean, I think it's clear from anyone reading it that we don't think it's fair for that matter that Henry Ford makes millions and someone in, Milpitas assembly plant makes
less. Then you're getting to a different government. Then you're getting to a much more different type of situation.
We
don't govern those prices by the government.
At this point, we get back to where we were about a month ago, which is the charge of monopoly. And we'll get back to the charge of monopoly with both people here in the studio. But first, let me take a fast look at the weather. Harry Geis says, for KGO listeners, fog or low clouds near the coast extending inland night and morning, otherwise fair, with some high clouds at times. Highs tomorrow in the upper 60s, low 70s inland, occasionally gusty westerly winds. How would you like to get a Gabriel racing jacket free at Metro Park Tire Center? A nylon warm-up jacket like the ones that race drivers use in sizes to fit anyone in your family. Just buy a set of Gabriel shocks, any four shocks except economy replacements, and this handsome racing jacket is yours free at Metro Park Tire Center. Gabriel's a lively part of the racing scene. Gabriel shocks are used at tracks like Indianapolis, Daytona, Ontario, used by Al Unser, Richard Petty, Dan Gurney, and Parnelli Jones. But Gabriel isn't only out to win races. What Gabriel learns on the racetrack goes to make your car a better performer on the road. So replacing your old shocks with heavy-duty Gabriels could give you quick handling, a stable ride, and comfort with control. And remember, when you buy a set of four, you get your Gabriel racing jacket free at Metro Park Tire Center, Mission at 10th in San Francisco.
Here's the windup and the pitch. Strike call on the outside corner. My, my, my. McCaffrey has great velocity this afternoon. He's mixing up his pitches well.
Mm-hmm. And what great football weather, Al.
Oh, that's baseball game.
Mm-hmm. Look at the suit on that scorekeeper in the press box. I bet you that came from Groden.
Yes, indeed. He swung on and called Colonel by the man in blue.
Actually, that's a Groden's vested pinstripe. Three P's.
Two strikes.
Two floor shine.
And the next offering, a swing and a miss. Strike three. He's history. Two down on the base. He's still molding.
What a nice fit. I'm going to Groden's tomorrow.
Pinch hitter. That looks to me like...
They've got Dominic DeBruzzi.
Mm-hmm, that's right, rookie from El Paso.
They've got Yves Saint-Laurent.
Acquired to trade from Montreal.
And Steinbach.
Part of a six-player deal with Minnesota. Well, Ken, the side's now retired from seventh-inning stretch. Let's listen to that bit.
Take a break from the game and go to Groden's for great savings on slats. Save one-third to one-half on Groden's famous label slats, now just $19.90. Imagine quality tailored dress slacks now for the price of jeans. Start the season right. Save one-third to one-half on slacks from Groden's. On go the mics once again. And Bill Graham, you're mentioned here on page 153 in Steve Chappell's book, Rock and Roll's Here to Pay. It says, and here's a partial quote, it will be a future of growing consolidation of the concert business. As profits drop off on individual concerts, there will be further moves toward monopoly. This direction is already suggested by Bill Graham's recent practice of working with a single artist over a national market area. The approach simplifies bargaining and accounting procedures for the act, provides an absolutely uniform production job, and obviously is attractive to the selected promoter. Is this the phrase, the part about monopoly, that got to you when you phoned in that evening?
It's always the word monopoly. If an artist takes an act around the country, that has nothing to do with monopoly. It's a relationship between a producer and an artist. Now, Liberace has been doing it for the last 30 years. Arthur Godfrey did it. Fred Waring does it. It's done by many artists. Victor Borger does it to great parts of the country. Frank Sinatra does it in many parts of the country. But the minute somebody does it in the free society, let me explain that point. If you relate to monopoly in a particular area where another producer cannot rent a hall or rent a facility, a stadium, that's a monopoly. If a competitive producer cannot get acts, new or old, that's a monopoly. But in 1974, I think it was, I was very privileged. Bob Dylan and I got together, and he said, after 10 years, I'd like to go out. I don't want to work with 93 different people. Would you like to do it? Well, how many times have you walked through the forest and there was a gold mine sitting there in front of you, and a pretty one at that, and an attractive one with a great artist involved? So we did that one, and then we did another one with Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, and then we did another tour with George Harrison over a period of about a year and a half. At this time, most of the promoters in the country and many of the managers and most of the agents decided to have a meeting in Long Island, which you spoke about here, at which they said, Bill, it's bad for the industry that you're doing this, that you're cutting out the promoters in those towns, you're cutting out the agent, there's no agency commission, and you're right. Cutting all these people out.
Right, that's what we say.
Fine, now, I looked at all these people, I said, you know, I've done very well with these tours. I liked the tours, it was exciting. My kids were able to come on the road in the summertime, made a lot of money, used my sound systems, our trucks, our personnel. I didn't know we were hurting anybody. I really didn't feel we were hurting anybody that badly. Is that what you feel? I voluntarily back off. Voluntarily. So long as it's never done to me. That I should be protected. So that if some other producers, if I back off and other people do that, and another promoter comes into San Francisco, where I do not have a monopoly, because it's been proven, if I had the monopoly, could other promoters, who, after I stopped doing it, started doing that, came into San Francisco, rented a building, and brought in an act that they did in Los Angeles, Vancouver, San Francisco, Salt Lake, Chicago, exactly what I was doing before. Now, my only contention was, to the agencies, this is what I think should be done. If I do not go around the country with a particular act, you have to try to follow this, then, if another promoter does it, let's say a promoter out of Boston or out of Philadelphia takes an act and goes across the country, as Bill Graham left San Francisco to go across the country, you, the agencies, who deal with that artist in his respective home turf, freeze him there. Do not sell him on his home turf if he goes across the country. Oh, yes, Bill, thank you very much.
They wouldn't agree to that.
Of course they did.
They did?
Yes.
Wait a minute.
Let's stay with that for a minute, because you see what we're doing? We have these wonderful little chit-chats between the three of us here. Then we go, all right, time for a commercial. Let's go on to the next one. Each one of these are direct accusations of me. My mimbling involvement with benefits, the fact that I closed the film was when I was losing money. Now we're getting to monopolies. But stay with this point. I voluntarily removed myself from a fortune, which is presently being made by two or three other producing companies who go across the country. Because 3 years ago, when I agreed to do this, I was given the impression by the major agencies that any promoter that takes an act across the country, we will just not make it that easy on his home turf. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I follow what I'm saying.
I did
it. Except for the one word voluntarily, yes. That's no differently than anything we say in the book. We say, in the next sentence is, if this had continued, if you'd been able to do Bob Dylan, George Harrison type tours cross country, it could be expanded to take in an increasing number of headline acts. If that had happened, this would be the first important split within the promotion monopoly of largely regional entrepreneurs.
What has happened?
In other words, what we're saying is, throughout the book and the whole and the monopoly system that we're saying, or what we call it, and we haven't defined what we mean by monopoly yet, is that different regional promoters, a person like Larry Magan in Philadelphia, a person like yourself in San Francisco, Don Law in Boston, have a relationship, not a contractual thing, but a sort of system that's built up over the years very naturally that gives you things like, in effect, right of first refusal over acts, not the fact that you can do 100% of the concerts of all people. That wouldn't make sense to the agencies. In fact, if someone like Don Law told us that Black Sabbath was offered to him, he didn't especially dig Black Sabbath. It seemed like a strange act to him, so he passed on it. Well, that meant the agency wanted to go ahead and do the concert, so they found somebody else to do it. I mean, I went down, took the time, and checked out the microfilm room of the last 6 months of the entertainment section of the Chronicles just to see what sort of a monopoly we'd be talking about. And it's true that that there was, for instance, David Forrest put on Steve Miller in the 6 months of 1977 in the Cow Palace. But if you add up the concerts that you did, some 57 in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, mm-hmm. The ones in San Francisco, you did 95% of the concerts. There was the Miller one and two in the Masonic Auditorium.
Rod Stewart at the Cow Palace. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. And then if you take the numbers and expand it out of San Francisco, the number of concerts done in Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco, you come up with 71%. That's of the number of concerts. But if you take it in terms of the dollar volume, presumably, and the number of people that went, mm-hmm. then you get up to a kind of
vanishing point, of which I would say it's about 95% of those of the conscious in those three areas. The reason why this is all sort of interesting in that, and much more than kind of academic interest, is that at this point, this system and this kind of control of a market is being challenged legally in Philadelphia. There's one person who's being investigated, excuse me, by the grand jury in Philadelphia for a restraint of trade and monopoly. It's something that's come to rock and roll that hit railroads or steel decades ago, and now it seems kind of strange, but it's happening here too.
I think you missed the whole point there, Steve, is that why not? You say, why is this one company doing all these shows? Now, what you're really saying is, why can't Charlie Putz get up on a Tuesday morning and decide that he wants to promote Elton John? You miss it so completely because you know, you've been around long enough, you have to know that in the end, an artist can work for anybody he wants to. There's only one power in this business. I don't know how many will say it. I'll say it. There's only one. That's the star. He can play whenever, wherever, for whomever he wants. Now, the problem in Philadelphia is not the same one that exists here. The reason there's a problem with an antitrust suit going on in Philadelphia is because you or I or Art or anybody else, you cannot rent the 20,000-seater in that town. You cannot rent. You cannot rent the Spectrum. I cannot rent the Spectrum. In order for me to work there, I must go into partnership with those people. Anybody in San Francisco can rent any facility in San Francisco. Now,
that's just one of the reasons why...
But there's no monopoly here. Now, if we do many of these shows, is it possible that we've earned it? Is it possible that perhaps Elton John likes to work with us, and Peter Frampton likes to work with us, or Peter and Fleetwood Mac would like to work for us, does like to work for us? Now, are there other promoters in the area? Yeah, and I'll tell you something. In 1965, when I started doing shows, there were other promoters here, and were they happy to see me? I remember a billboard convention a couple of years ago where a promoter in the middle of the United States stood up and complained about the young new whippersnapper college graduates with their marketing and merchandising degrees which going out there and promoting. And I raised my hand and I said, who were you 10 years ago? Didn't you graduate from the University of Cincinnati and you went there bucking the mainstays? Well, in 1965, Tom Donahue and some others were promoting shows and I had to buck them. And in order to get started, you start with the also-rans. So here, how should somebody get in to the promoting business?
Before you answer, Steve, may I take some time out for the people who are paying the freight here? Thank you. Are you one of the lovely, nature-loving people who get sick every time you see our magnificent countryside being covered with more and more concrete? Are you bringing more and more green plants into your home in a last desperate attempt to bring Mother Nature back into your life? Well, there's a way that you can escape from that concrete mess out there. It's VF-11 plant food. VF-11 is a great new plant food developed by hydroponic experts, which is going to make your plants just go bananas, even those which do not get direct sunlight. To remember the name, think of V for very and F for fine, for VF-11 is very fine indeed. You'll find this amazing VF-11 plant food in a black and white bottle at Alpha Beta, Fry's, Ralph's, Woolworth's, Lucky's, Gemco, Payless, Pay and Save, Safeway, and most garden supply shops in your area. For the location nearest to you, call Collect to Eleanor at area code 408-395-3955.
Poor old fashioned play. Take our advice. Barrel head root beer and don't spare the ice. It's real draft style root beer with real draft style form. Cause Carolyn has brought old style root beer home.
Root beer fans, get out a couple of mugs and see if your root beer can meet the Barrelhead Challenge. Yup, we'll go head-to-head against your favorite root beer and let you be the judge. Compare Barrelhead's good old-fashioned flavor, its full, rich, foamy head, the way it stands up to ice. Chances are you'll drain the Barrelhead mug clear on down to the bottom. But even your first sip will tell you.
For old-fashioned flavor, take our advice. Drink Barrelhead root beer and don't spare the ice.
Of a six-pack of Barrelhead root beer at Rebello's Markets. Rebello's offers USDA choice beef, daily fresh produce, and friendly service. Become part of their growing family. Shop Rebello's Markets. KGO time is 7:47. Sunday is Mother's Day, as important to many women as their birthday. You can make Mother's Day special with some help from Dunkin'. Dunkin' has two gifts for Mom absolutely free, a beautiful orchid corsage and a full-color photo of her wearing the corsage. The orchid and the photo are a $6.95 value, but they're free as long as supplies last this Saturday. No purchase necessary. Check today's paper for the Donkin Flyer and coupons. Quantities are limited, but you'll find exceptional savings. 14-carat gold chains as low as $16. American Tourister luggage for up to 50% off. A GE smoke alarm you might expect to pay $30 for, just $9.97 after receiving your GE rebate. And fine Hamilton watches with timeless styling, accurate, and even a case with four matching diamonds if you like. Why pay more for the exact same item when you can get it for less at Dunkin? The store with fine quality jewelry and 10,000 name brand items for less every day. Discover Dunkin near you in San Carlos, San Rafael, Hayward, Santa Rosa, Napa, and Petaluma. Friendly service since 1933. Now, what do you mean, Steve Chappell, by monopoly? If monopoly means that nobody else has a foot in the door in any one of the related services, we're talking about rock music now.
Well, that's not what monopoly means in terms of its definition, though.
Well, what does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, that's a complete monopoly. That's the kind of monopoly the British East India Company had on India. Anything that moves, walks, talks, or whatever in the 18th century was completely controlled by one company. Now, that's a lock, stock, and barrel monopoly. The phone company in America doesn't have a monopoly like that. There are little companies in different places that do some business, Southern California and so on. But the phone company, in most people's minds, is definitely a monopoly. It's a monopoly because, in some ways, it's a buyer and a seller at the same time.
Has he got a monopoly? Has Bill Graham got a monopoly in San Francisco?
Yeah, I would say that Bill Graham has a monopoly.
Have I got a monopoly on listeners? If this program, from 7 to 10 every night, has more listeners and people have a free choice of tuning on KGO or any other station, and if we have more listeners than the combined radio stations 2, 3, 4, 5, and most of 6, am I running a monopoly venture here when people have
no
free choice?
The reason
what's
is
the difference then between Graham and me?
The difference is, if you were doing a station in which the Bill Grahams of the world and the best authors and the most interesting and scintillating people when the Arnold Schwarzeneggers come around, if they only come to the Art Finley show...
That's right.
Because they work with agencies that have over time developed relationships with the Art Finley show, then that is restraint of trade.
No,
and
they come on my program
about
because we're number one in the ratings.
Right, that's different. See, out there, those other people presumably have a chance to put you on. They can go on Larry Lee and K-San if they want for the talkies
sure
versus yourself. That's competition.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because, as I said, they don't have a relationship with a talent booking agency that puts them into the town in a certain way.
But that relationship was gained and earned. That relationship has been built over the years. Now, if a new promoter wants to get into our business, what you're saying is literally the only way he can really do so is to go to a major agency and say, I would like to buy Fleetwood Mac. Now, they can go to Fleetwood Mac and say, listen, Mick, there's this new guy, Charlie Putz, who wants to play you in San Francisco. Now, if Mick Fleetwood said, listen, we've been playing with Bill for 10 years. We like the way he presents us. Why should they change? Now, if this same guy still is persistent and wants to put on a show, do you know what he's going to have to put up with at the beginning? Leftovers. That's how you start in this business. Either leftovers, or you have your eye on something new, or you say, what is Bill doing, or what is he not doing that we think could catch? Is he hip to Crystal Gayle? Is he hip to Dolly Parton? Is he hip to some Israeli dance group that some other promoters may see that I'm not doing and get
sure
your foot in the door?
We're not saying that's any different. If country music underwent an incredible explosion, for instance, there was one of these exception concerts. It was Willie Nelson at the Oakland Auditorium. If all of a sudden everybody quit going to Santana and Eddie Money, decided they wanted to go see Willie Nelson in the Bay Area,
yeah,
it's never going to happen, then that would put out those kind of agencies in the cold, those agencies that had built up their reputations on rock, and would put out you unless you were fast enough to move.
I must remind you that Willie Nelson just played in Oakland Coliseum under the aegis of a promoter from Denver. There's another show coming in out of the aegis of a promoter from Atlanta, Georgia, who's coming in with a show this Sunday with Parliament Funkadelics. This idea of monopoly, we happen to live here, we happen to employ 130 people here, I happen to have a payroll of over $40,000 a week here, and yet if you want to get into my business, you can do so. What you object to is the difficulty. And do you know why it's difficult?
I don't object
to that. Because you can make a lot of money, a lot of money, and you can lose a lot of money. And if a guy has the choice of waking up on a Tuesday morning to fill out an application to be a plumber or a pipe fitter or a truck driver or take a shot in one that's making 8, 10, or 12 grand, why shouldn't he?
Well, see, I think, you know, your idea of what a monopoly is and what constitutes it is a charitable one. It's different than what the Justice Department would see it, and it's different, you know, naturally than we would in our book. I mean, the charges in Philadelphia against Larry Magid, who hasn't been indicted, and
I know
we shouldn't
what the
give,
are.
We shouldn't
a
give,
very good promoter.
We shouldn't give that kind of implication, but what the investigation is about is much more than just what you're saying there.
I know what it is. Larry's a very good friend of mine.
The two other parts of the charges are that he has a relationship with all named rock acts with certain agencies, and that was gotten by a woman named Claire Rizzaldi, who taped herself and taped the
Wait
conversation.
A minute. There's a parallel. There's a parallel in recent history to monopoly in show business. It was MCA. When MCA was forced to divest itself of, what, half of its business, theoretically,
right,
as a talent agent and as an entertainment venture.
You can't make any...
Do you see any parallel between MCA of the old days and Bill Graham today?
Well, I think you're coming to that, and sometimes you do. You can't make films and have a talent agency as well. I mean, that's because you have a buyer and a seller situation. Now, some people have pointed out that that's not a lot different than managing an act and putting them on in your hall or in a hall that you rent as
there's
well.
There's a slight point here that when I present an act that I manage, I do not collect commission. Management commission. I treat him as I would have any other artist. I do not take my management money when I'm producing that show.
Well,
that's also voluntary.
I don't mean, you know, to impugn your motives in any way, but it's like a structural problem. If you're in a position where you can have a conflict of interest, right, whether you say that you're, you know, a completely honest person and that the books are there...
I didn't say completely honest. I said I'm an honest
person. And that you show...
Define your
right,
terms.
I don't know. Maybe I should jump into that breach and go...
Take it and run.
If you say that Carlos Santana gets to see the books and he knows that for example, if you put him on in Winterland and you're also the manager, you make sure that he's not getting beaten on that, as somebody in the 50s might very well have been. That's one thing, but to something like the Justice Department, that you promoters and yourself as a promoter are still in a position where there's a conflict of interest. You know, if you wanted to, in other words, you could go ahead and do that, and who's to say that you can? And that's why in the film industry, something like MCA can't have both a record company of film production and control talent agencies. Same thing happened with Warner Communications.
Did you ever get any heat at all for any government?
Never.
With an allegation of monopoly or an allegation
I've never
of...
never had anyone visit me from the government except looking for AWOL guys.
That doesn't count. Have you got a piece of a radio station
no.
that we don't know about?
No. Not a newspaper, not a radio station.
See, well, what we're talking about, say, if you start off with in Boston, for instance.
Jay's here, and you know, when he's aroused, he can just hit me severely and put me out of commission. Stick around after the news, because I want to open the lines, all right? I'll open the lines after the news. Sure. If anybody's got his questions about what we've been talking about tonight, if they don't, then we'll cool it, and we'll do something else.
KGO Harry Guy's weather forecast, fog or low clouds near the coast extending inland.